Okay, you guys, no matter if you're training for something big or you're just trying to get lean and stay healthy, your body requires a lot of protein. In fact, around 1 gram per pound of body weight. Now, cooking whole foods is best, but I'm going to be honest, sometimes I need help hitting my protein count with clean, on-the-go nutrition that works for both myself and my family. But that is a lot harder than it sounds. I've been searching for months to find a super clean, affordable protein powder that actually tastes good, has a full amino acid profile, and doesn't upset my stomach. Finally, I found Equip Foods Prime Protein. And seriously, you guys, I am hooked. Prime Protein has over 2,000 five-star reviews because there's no junk, fillers, or additives ever. Equip's unflavored grass-fed beef isolate protein powder has only one ingredient. All of their flavors taste amazing. Vanilla happens to be my favorite. They mix well. They can be added to countless low-carb and keto recipes. You can make a quick shake with just one scoop and get a 21-gram protein instantly. You guys, that's like eating 4 ounces of steak. Every single batch of Prime Protein is certified non-GMO and is free of glyphosate and heavy metals. If you need a delicious, easy-to-use, easy-to-digest, clean protein powder, seriously, you guys need to check out Equip. You can save 15% off with my code DRFIT, D-R-F-I-T, at equipfoods.com. And by the way, every single bag comes with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't love it, send it back for a full refund. No questions asked. To the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Hello, everybody. It is Dr. Jamie, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It's so amazing to have you here today. I have an incredible guest that I have been super excited about bringing on the podcast because we are going to talk about something near and dear to my heart. I talk to you guys all the time about it. It is such an important aspect of our health. But before we get to that, I want to introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Meredith Broderick. She is a medical doctor and she is triple board certified, a sleep neurologist, and she's based in Seattle, Washington. Her passion is combining holistic, preventative, allopathic, and behavioral sleep medicine to optimize health and wellness. In her personal life, she's passionate about the performing arts, outdoor adventures. She's climbed some of the highest mountains on planet Earth. She sees patients one-on-one from her boutique sleep practice, the Sound Sleep Guru. She also shares from her life tips as a sleep medicine specialist on both Instagram and TikTok. You can go find her. She's at Sleep Dr. Mare. So we'll put that link in the bio. Dr. Meredith Broderick, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have such an interesting background. There's not a lot of people that do what you do. So if you can just kind of tell our listeners kind of your pathway to medicine and what kind of inspired this passion.
Sure. Well, my mother was a professor at the medical school where I lived in Northeastern Ohio. So I got to see human brains and cadavers when I was, you know, like 8-10 years old. And I always saw it as kind of a revered profession. And I loved Oliver Sacks books. And I think I looked up to my mom a lot and her colleagues. So that was probably what led me into it. And then I ended up going into neurology. And as you know, when you do your medical training, it's very centered more around inpatient care than outpatient care. And in neurology, the number one thing that you do is you take care of people who have strokes. And I just kind of reached a breaking point with it, probably a combination of sleep deprivation and then just, you know, we don't get a lot of help dealing with the trauma that we're seeing and the suffering. And it was like, you know, just wanting to walk out of the ICU and go Real Housewives and like turn everything over and be like, if I have to tell one more family that you can withdraw care or send your loved one traked and pegged to an LTAC, I'm going to just, what's the point of all this? You know, so that's kind of how I got into sleep medicine. Was a faculty member had brought that up to me that it was a growing field. I went to Stanford for a visiting rotation as a resident. And, you know, these people are looking at prevention of vascular disease. They're looking at prevention of neurological disease. And, you know, as you know, with neurological disease, once it gets to that end stage, there's not a lot to do. So that, I mean, that's the quick summary.
Yeah. Can you talk to us, why is sleep so important to our health?
Well, sleep is a physiologic need. It's kind of like asking, why is food and water important? It is a basic function. Now, the way we learn to sleep, the way we sleep is learned. So it's a behavioral, there's a behavioral aspect to it, but everything from learning, from repair of our body, from cleansing the brain of waste products is associated with sleep. It's just a basic function that's needed for life. Something just happened where I can't hear you anymore.
There we go. So you were talking about sleep being a learned behavior. So let's go back to when we're born, essentially. Can you talk about through the life when we're a baby and we become toddlers and children and adults, when we say learned behavior, I mean, how do we learn to sleep?
Yes. Well, if you think about sleep, it's the most vulnerable time of our day. If you're thinking about us living out in the wild before we have these safe homes and modern civilization. So as we evolve from, think about our ape relatives, they sleep in trees. And as humans, one thing that makes us unique from other primates is that we sleep on the ground. And when that evolutionary leap happened, we sleep less and we sleep more consolidated. So we sleep a lot less than our ape relatives, but we're vulnerable to predators. So learning how to sleep is very important for safety. And there are certain things that are kind of common. So you want to learn how to sleep somewhere that you're in a safe environment, right? And you want to be able to wake up if you're not safe. So there's a huge element of teaching people how to sleep. And I think in modern civilization, it's very, quote unquote, unnatural to sort of sleep in your own bedroom by yourself. We would sleep together in a, you know, more in a communal fashion, probably out as hunters and gatherers for safety. So now in modern times, we have to teach our kids to sleep independently, right? Like there's things like putting your kid on their back to sleep and sleeping in a crib without anything around it because we know about SIDS and sudden infant death. So we're teaching children to sleep in these more and more optimal and ideal and safer conditions that didn't necessarily exist into the hunter-gatherer population.
What are most people, what are reasons that people are not sleeping well? We've defined that it's extremely important, but this is a huge issue that I definitely see in medicine that people are not sleeping well. What are some of the most common reasons why people don't sleep well?
Well, stress is a really, I think that's an obvious common one, but I think another really big one that's coming out is with the ubiquity of LED lighting and our disconnection from being outdoors and connected to the solar cycle of the sun, those are really huge ones that I think people don't think about. And we're just so used to it. We don't even notice.
Can you dive a little deeper on that and just the physiology? What does the sunlight have to do with us sleeping well and blue light and these LEDs that you're talking about?
Yeah, so we're really meant to live in sync with the solar cycle, meaning the light-dark cycle of the sun. I think of it as a yin and yang. And that's really what communicates a message to the body about when it's nighttime and when it's daytime. And as humans, we're really meant to be awake during the daylight hours and then to sleep at night because our visual system is not so good at night. So nowadays, with light everywhere, we kind of are getting a signal to our brains that it's daytime all the time or more displaced into the evening because a lot of us are getting electronics in the evening and that's very unnatural. If you've ever spent any time in the outdoors camping, you'll know that it's pitch black. And even outside, even if you get your house like really dark and blackout shades, it's still lighter just because of like street lights and city lights and buildings and helicopters and airplanes. So that is giving our brain a different signal. And so compared to our ancestors, we're sleeping later. We're sleeping, our schedule is displaced a little later and we're sleeping less. And so we're just not getting, we're not in this nice rhythm metronome that we would be with only the sun. There's all kinds of light signals coming in now, especially the blue light, and then not getting some of the other type of light we would get from like sunrise and sunset.
So you mentioned we should be sleeping, our sleep patterns, I mean, the time of day or whatnot. So we're staying up too late, essentially. Can you talk about, is there an optimal time that we should be getting in bed, when we should be waking up, and how much sleep we actually need?
I would say yes and no. I think our greatest, you know, you'll hear like that famous TED talk by Matt Walker where he says like sleep is our superpower. You know, our superpower really is adaptability and wakefulness. It's our ability to not sleep when we need to get stuff done. So if someone, you know, for instance, I know for you, you probably have on call and you probably don't get to choose your work hours all the time. And so I'm not going to say that to someone like, you know, has a job like you, because that's not helpful, right?
Quit your job. Your job and start sleeping better.
So there's an ideal time for you that makes you adaptable and to get your sleep schedule in line the most you can. So the way really in modern times to do that is to try to control the environment around you. Like, I love the story. There was this professor I had dinner with at Harvard, who's like a chronobiology professor. And he consulted with like a rock star who didn't want to go on tour in Asia because he hated having jet lag. So they just created what they called like this rock star's time zone. And they created this environment around him to be in alignment with what he would need to do so he didn't have to experience jet lag.
Interesting. Let's talk about things that really mess up sleep. First one is alcohol. What does alcohol do to sleep?
Alcohol steals deep sleep. You know, it's a sedative. So I think another thing a lot of people notice, especially as they get older, is you get this surge in your sympathetic nervous system when it wears off. So people will oftentimes like wake up feeling very anxious and then maybe even hungover, but it definitely significantly degrades the quality of sleep.
Let's talk about heat and cold. I know in a particular part of my menstrual cycle after ovulation, I get really hot and sometimes I will awake and be throwing the covers off. Are we supposed to be hot or cold when we sleep? What's the ideal temperature for sleep?
You know, the ideal temperature is probably going to be somewhere between like 65 and 68, but it's definitely colder than most of us might realize. Again, going back to that solar cycle, these rhythms in nature, it's cold outside at night. So one of the ways that we adapted as humans was we actually move our blood volume from our extremities and our muscles into the core to protect our heat. You know, our heat is energy. We don't think about starving to death anymore, but, you know, hunters and gatherers, that was a big deal. It was having enough food and energy. So one of the things that happens is the core body temperature lowers to conserve energy. And that's part of this. Also, these circadian rhythms is this thermoregulatory process. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why things like exercise and like sauna and cold plunges is really helpful for sleep, is because what you're doing is you're challenging the autonomic nervous system. And sleep is really an autonomic event because the core body temperature goes down. There's these shifts in blood volumes. That's also why I think exercising at night, they always say that's bad, is because you're shifting your blood volume into your muscles. And that's, you know, it's going to take longer to transition into sleep.
I know I started doing a lot more cold plunging in the last few years, and I have one in my house now. And I do it at night because I want to do it more than 12 hours away from a resistance training session because it can blunt muscle protein synthesis. But I get comments and people are like, wait, why are you doing that before bedtime? That's really going to mess up your sleep. I sleep amazing on the nights that I do it. Now, I'm not doing it right before sleep. I mean, there's a couple of, you know, hours between then and when I lay down. But can you talk about that? Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? Is there an ideal amount of time in between bedtime and if you're going to do some sort of cold or sauna therapy even?
Yeah, there's a lot of mixed messaging about this, I think, out there, because I've seen people say like to like vasodilate to get rid of the heat before sleep to lower the body temperature. And I'm not really sure if there's evidence behind like either way, like doing the ice bath. But to me, like just intuitively, it would make sense to cool your body because that's the direction you're going. You know, I guess some people might argue, well, you're going to vasoconstrict all everything from doing that, and then your body's going to have a harder time. But I mean, you just lowered your temperature. You just got rid of so much heat by doing that. In mm-hmm. fact, I think you have to be careful. Like one of the things I tell people about cold plunging, I don't know if this has happened to you, but because you get such an endorphin rush and feel really good, I've seen people get hypothermic from doing it because they stay in too long.
Yeah, I do in about 3 to 5 minutes. I agree with you. People are like overdoing it. The water's too cold. They're staying in there for too long. But it's like, you know, anything on the internet, like I can do it longer and better than you.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah. It's you got to find the balance. That's for sure. Let's talk about snoring. What's the deal with snoring?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on this big rant on social media lately about snoring because, like, as a sleep doctor, it's the precancerous lesion to a stroke, right? I mean, wow. It is the precursor to, you know, my mentor Christian Gumino, who was like the father of obstructive sleep apnea, sleep disorder, breathing. He would always say, like, the first sign of pathophysiology or a pathological disease occurs in sleep. And for cardiovascular disease, it's snoring. And as you know, cardiovascular disease and cerebrovascular disease are synonymous in some ways. I mean, there's differences in like vessel sizes and things like that. But in general, we're talking about atherosclerotic disease. And so snoring is this, you know, I think of obstructive sleep apnea as a neurodegenerative disease. It is very, very much a neurodegenerative disease where once you get to severe sleep apnea, you're not going to fix it with anything but a CPAP. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter how big you make the airway, the brain has lost control of the airway. The sensory aspect of the upper airway reflex is not working, and people have basically neuropathy in the lining of the upper airway from the snoring that's caused a vibration injury over years and years.
Interesting. Okay, so if somebody listening right now is like, oh my gosh, really precancerous? Like, if somebody's snoring, what's the next best step to figure this out and get resolution?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on what is the snoring a sign of sleep apnea, or is the snoring a sign of something else? And that's what really where someone like me who has a clinical expertise can look at the person and say, oh, you know what, you have nasal turbinate hypertrophy, your septum's deviated, you have allergies. That's really, we just need to kind of jump on that versus, oh my gosh, your oxygen's dropping to 74% every night. I think we need to get you a sleep apnea treatment. And really, I mean, in the ideal world, what you're going to do is you're going to start to identify these things in childhood because they start in childhood. And we, you know, sleep doctors, it's not the eyes are the window to the soul. It's the mouth is the window to the soul, because I can tell if you're a mouth breather. I can tell if you sucked your thumb. I can tell, you know, how you're chewing, how your teeth are alignment. And that's going to tell me if you're going to snore and develop sleep apnea.
Interesting. I've heard so many experts. We've had people on the podcast talking about mouth breathing, nasal breathing. What about mouth taping? I mean, if somebody is a mouth breather, what are tips, solutions, tricks, things they can do to become a nasal breather?
Yes. I am a big fan, actually, of mouth taping. I mean, we don't want to just like put a Band-Aid on and cover up someone who, let's say, has like moderate to severe sleep apnea. That's what we really don't want to do. But the way, you know, the way to breathe through your nose is, one, to have a good nasal airway. So I tell people, think about the nose like a box. Your box needs to be clean. It can't be crowded with, you know, inferior nasal turbinates and polyps and things like that. So you have to have good nasal airway, but you also want to have like good width so that your tongue can lightly suction to the roof of your mouth and not fall into the back of your throat. That's what's really going to help with, like, you know, breathing during sleep. That's why we want your mouth to be closed. We want your mouth to be closed so that your tongue stays there. And then there's also this idea that having the airflow through the nose helps with like parasympathetic tone and, you know, oral microbiome and things like that. So it can be an element of like habit to breathe through the mouth. And so that's where mouth taping can help, is to help, you know, prevent the habit of opening the mouth, reminding, giving a feedback to keep the mouth closed, and then to keep the tongue lightly suctioned in the back of the throat. So if it is more of a habitual phenomenon, that's where mouth taping can really help.
That's good advice. I was pretty certain I was breathing through my nose, but I got some mouth tape that has like a little slit in it because I am a little bit claustrophobic, and the idea of like slapping this thing on my mouth was like it gave me a little anxiety. But I did it a few times and I noticed that I did really improve like my deep sleep, because there probably is intermittent times in the night maybe where I'm opening my mouth. I'm not really sure. I'd have to like film myself. My partner has never said I snore or anything like that. But off and on, I will sometimes mouth tape if I need like a really good, you know, night's sleep. What about some of these sleep devices, like wearable devices that are tracking sleep? Like, what's your opinion on these things?
I'm a big fan of wearables. I think of wearables like food diaries and these apps that track food. People have cognitive biases where they don't remember the level of detail, or they forget things that you really need to pay attention to. And so in research, there's something called the Hawthorne effect, which is when someone knows they're being watched or studied, that they improve their behavior. And that's the real benefit of sleep trackers, is to give people that more awareness and then also want to try to perform a little bit using the wearable. I think they have a ways to go in providing people with actionable tips and how, you know, to be more dynamic with what to do beyond what they're already doing now. And there are definitely some people who get a little bit obsessive compulsive, and the data makes them anxious. But I think they're giving people too much data and not really, it's not really clear like what these sleep scores and things mean. But They're a step in the right direction, right? You have to make iterations and improve, and I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, I'll wear you know, like the Aura Ring or things like that intermittently. I'm not good about using it consistently, but it's always interesting to see the scores, because sometimes I wake up and I'm like, I feel amazing, and it doesn't give me as good a score as I feel, or vice versa. I'm like, oh, I don't feel that great, and it says you're like ready to go. So it's like, am I really supposed to modify my day or my behavior? Or I feel like I'm kind of in tune with my body and what I need as far as like recovery or those types of things. Talk to me about sleep aids. I mean, I have patients that are like, I've been on melatonin for years, or I take some sort of sleepy time tea, or I'm using CBD or whatever it is. Are these things helpful or hurtful for good sleep?
Like all things, I think there are good, you know, just like wearables, there are positive sides and negative sides. Sleep aids can be extremely helpful for people. They're a very important tool to use. It's that you don't want to use them to cover up some other underlying issue, whether it's, you know, generalized anxiety or chronic insomnia, or sleep apnea for that matter. I think those are some of the band-aids. So short term, the natural history of sleep aids is usually they work for a while, then they stop working and someone has to go to someone else. So once you kind of start to see that pattern that I need more and more and more, and now it's not working, and now I've gone through 3 or 4 or 5, that's when you know, okay, we need to like look at something else. But some sleep aids, like let's say a sleepy time tea, which just has like chamomile in it, right? Is that what's in sleepy time tea? I think
I've seen a lot of different varieties, and I feel like you got to look at the ingredient label, because yeah. Some company sent me one time, and I slept so hard I slept through 3 phone calls from the hospital. So
oh, no. I don't usually in it? Did you look?
Well, yeah, of course it said proprietary blend. And so I had to go to their website and look, and it had a pretty mega dose of melatonin in it, but there was, you know, like valerian root and some, it did not have CBD. There was like 4 or 5 different things, but wow, like I've never been that deep in sleep before.
That makes sense that there was a lot of melatonin in it. Yeah. So for something, let's just say like a sleepy time tea where it's just a little bit of chamomile, I love that because it's a sleep ritual. And again, it touches back on what we were talking about. It's like a behavioral thing. So the brain wants to recognize these patterns for safety. And if the brain knows, like, we have our sleepy time tea and then we fall asleep and we're safe, then it tells the brain kind of, you know, that pattern, and it can be self-reinforcing. We think that's really healthy.
Interesting. We were talking about these different stages in our life. And one thing that I encounter as an OBGYN is women who are having hormonal changes and going through menopause. Can you talk about what happens with sleep when we make transitions like this?
Definitely. I mean, I see this every day. I mean, a huge thing in sleep medicine is women, I mean, a couple things. One, women develop a much higher risk for sleep disordered breathing. That's a very common presentation of sleep apnea in women, is very unsuspecting because I don't snore, I don't gasp for air, but I wake up in the middle of the night and I can't go back to sleep. A lot of times I have high sympathetic tone. I might have night sweats, urination, racing thoughts. Very common presentation of sleep disordered breathing. And sometimes it's even hard to get women to test because they're like convinced they don't have it, but you really don't know unless you test. But then also with the hormonal changes, we think that's, you know, that's having an effect on the brain, right? I mean, all the receptors. And so that's where I think HRT can come in really helpful if it's appropriate, you know, and they've had like a risk benefit analysis with someone like you. I just want to see women stop saying like, oh, this is just perimenopause or menopause. It's just aging, those kinds of things. Like, we can do stuff about this. Sometimes we do need to do like a more behavioral intervention, like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, because the way that some women respond to that is by doing these maladaptive behaviors that kind of self-reinforce it. So we want to look at all those things. I think we want to look at the hormonal. We want to look at sleep disorder breathing screening as a preventative health strategy, and also, you know, improving quality of life. And then we also want to look at these behavioral aspects too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a common time for women to come in and just say, I'm not sleeping well. I'm having trouble falling asleep. I'm having trouble staying asleep. And I have seen time and time again that hormone replacement can really be helpful, especially progesterone. It works as kind of a neurosteroid. It's very calming because they almost feel unnerved and very anxious in this transition. And if that, of course, is not helping them calm down and, you know, get into this restful, peaceful state. So I love micronized progesterone. I think it does help with sleep. I have patients take it about an hour before bedtime for that reason. So I'm a huge fan of that. And it can be a really hard time for people because then, even if it's just the sleep, they're not sleeping well, and then they wake up and now they turn to, you know, more coffee beverages and more this and more that, and it becomes this, you know, vicious cycle for them.
Do you have people take just the progesterone, or do you always do a combination with estrogen?
So for women who take estrogen and have a uterus, they have to take progesterone with it. But you can take progesterone by itself. So if for some reason, you know, maybe as an example, somebody who's kind of in early perimenopause where they're still getting a lot of sometimes high estrogen surges, maybe we're just going to use progesterone in that stage. And at some point add in estrogen. If they have had a hysterectomy, they can be on estrogen only therapy and not take progesterone. But progesterone, like I said, has some benefits, especially with like anxiety and insomnia. So it's very individualized. And then sometimes testosterone too. We don't think about that one with sleep necessarily, but there's some nuances involved with hormone replacement. For instance, if you give estrogen, it increases sex hormone binding globulin, which can decrease their free testosterone. And you don't want to, you know, treat one issue and make another. So I'm a huge fan of hormone replacement therapy for a variety of reasons. There is a reduction in all-cause mortality for patients that use it within 10 years of menopause. There's less cardiovascular disease, less diabetes, less colon cancer, stronger bones. I mean, there's a lot of reasons beyond just hot flashes and night sweats and vaginal dryness and things that the patients actually complain about. But I'm a huge fan, and I have seen it play a big role in getting restful sleep.
Yeah, I'm a big fan too. I'm glad there are people like you out there, because like my mom just fell and broke her pelvis, and she was like one of these women who had a hysterectomy when she was like in her 30s and never took HRT, of course, because of the Women's Health Initiative. And
yeah,
we're going to see like the negative effects of that now.
Yeah, there's a whole few decades of women that were not really treated in the most appropriate fashion. So we're seeing the pendulum swing, which is good. Talk to me about the snooze button. I get up on my first alarm, but I was not always that way, but I don't have that luxury anymore. I got to get up. I got surgeries to get to and kids to get out the door. But what happens when we hit the snooze button?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because I think that thinking in sleep medicine for a really long time was that, you know, don't snooze, because then you're not really getting any quality sleep after. And then you're just cutting off, like, just get up, you know, set your alarm for the time you're actually going to get up. But there's been a couple of studies that have come out this past year showing that, that one, it kind of helps some people like slowly wake up. Cause you know, we're talking about that like temperature change where sleep isn't really a switch. It's this transition that happens with our blood volume and our temperature and things like slowly booting up. And so I think some people just need that slow boot, and that's kind of what they're doing with the snooze. And the studies are really showing that it's not really diminishing their, you know, their sleep duration or quality by using it. So I think in your example, for instance, you were sleeping through the snooze because you were sleep deprived as, you know, like a medical professional in training. But so that's what we want to do, is we want to distinguish between someone who just snoozes a couple times and they're otherwise healthy. They feel alert during the day. They get good sleep quality, versus someone who literally can't wake up because they didn't go to bed and, you know, they only got 5 hours of sleep and then they feel awful during the day. So that's where I'd want to make the distinction. So the snooze is not, again, like, it's not all bad or all good.
So if it's like a one-off thing, it's okay. But if you're like a chronic, maybe five times hit the snooze button, it never makes sense to me. I'm like, well, just set your alarm later if you're going to never wake up when it goes off. But, okay. Talk to me about naps. Are naps a good idea?
Naps are a really great idea. I think they're a really important tool to use for sleep. Scientifically, we think that just like there's these different chronotypes or, you know, different variations in neurodiversity, there are some people who just aren't nappers. Like they're going to say, I don't need to take a nap. I could never take a nap. But then there's also people who really benefit from naps. And, you know, there are different types of naps. So there's like the power nap. I think that's probably the nap that we're most familiar with. And researchers have done studies to see, you know, if you give someone like neuropsych and like athletic performance tests before and after a nap, how long or short would it be to see the ideal performance enhancements? And it's like 17 minutes, because what they found is you need to get into stage two sleep. So it has to be long enough that you get into stage two. So you go stage one, stage two, and then you need a certain length of stage two. And I forget how many minutes it is, but then you want to abort it before you go into stage three, because that's where you kind of wake up with that sleep drunkenness or that, you know, sleep inertia. And so 17 minutes is the ideal. So that's where, if anyone's ever heard of like Daniel Pink's Nappuccino, it's like you take a shot of coffee and then you set your alarm for, let's say, 25 minutes. That allows you a couple minutes to fall asleep and then sleep for 17 minutes or 20 minutes and then wake up. And there's, you know, there's an improvement. There's also something called like the perfect nap. And this is Sarah Mednick. She's a researcher, where basically what you're aiming for is one sleep cycle, which is 90 minutes. And if you're looking to get more REM sleep for more of like a creative function, then you're going to want to get it in the first half of the day. If you want to get more deep sleep, then you're going to get it more in the afternoon. But the perfect nap is right at the inflection point, right in the center of the day, which is more around like between 1 and 3 p.m. for most people. So there's different strategies to help nap. And so when and why you might take them depends on why, you know, what you're aiming for.
Interesting. So 17 minutes, 90 minutes, can maybe play with it, see if it makes you more tired or more awake. Talk to me about energy drinks are like all the rage. So when it comes to caffeine and stimulants, what should people be thinking about as far as sleep goes?
I think of caffeine a little bit like sleeping pills, in that they can be a really helpful tool, but if you're overusing them, they probably have a net negative. So what you want to do is have like a really moderate amount of caffeine use. It is a performance enhancing drug. So I want people to have like maybe one serving a day and then use something like, you know, an extra coffee or an energy drink when they need it, when it is, like for you, for instance, if you're on call and it's just, you're really sleep deprived, that would be an ideal time to use it. I'm like, in general, I'm not a big fan of energy drinks just because I think they have too much. But people will build up a tolerance to them and then have withdrawal when they don't get it. So it just becomes like an addiction, So I'm all about like using it, but very much in moderation.
Yeah. It just seems like left and right, people are like drinking these. I mean, some of these things have 300 milligrams and more and more and more. And some people metabolize it very slowly. It's probably still hanging around when they're trying to go to sleep at night. It's just insane. My husband and I did last October, like a 30 days with no caffeine. We didn't really think we had a problem until we said, let's not do this for 30 days. And then I'm like, oh, wow, I turn to these different things probably more often than I realized. And I actually, within a couple of days, was sleeping even better than I ever had before, and felt more energized during the day without the caffeine. Like I had more energy without the caffeine drink. So I think there's, you got to figure out what's working best for you. We talked a little bit about wearable devices. Give us some insight. Is there anything new with technology or AI when it comes to sleep?
I think there is definitely a ton on the horizon with sleep and wearables. I think a lot of these companies maybe aren't sharing so much, like for instance, these sleep scores. But like for instance, I just saw an article that came out this year about a new data point called the Sleep Regularity Index, which a lot of us hear about, like total sleep time and sleep efficiency. But I think we're gonna have these other biomarkers that really help tell us. And the Sleep Regularity Index is actually a better predictor of all-cause mortality than sleep duration. And that was a huge study out of the UK. It was like a couple, 60,000 participants or something like that. As far as AI, that's a huge, huge thing in sleep medicine. And in my field, I don't think there's going to be a sleep lab anymore in about, 10 years or something like that. I think we're going to be able to do all these things at home, and monitoring people in their home as a superior way to study people in their, in their natural environment.
Isn't that how most are done now? I feel like I don't have many patients going to the sleep lab anymore. Are they not always mostly done at home now?
Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Which makes sense, right? To be like in your own environment. I feel like it would feel very odd and unfamiliar to go into a sleep lab.
Yeah, it is very odd. There's some advantages to it. I mean, there are some people that struggle using this technology at home and knowing what they're doing. I think also there's some logistical problems with trying to dispense the deploy the devices and get them back, and still only getting a few nights. And I think that's the huge jump that wearables are making, is instead of studying someone for like one or two nights, you can study people for a few weeks and really get a lot more sense of what's going on. Because sleep is really more like nutrition or exercise. Like you can't tell someone what they did like two times and then be like, oh, okay, let me get you a plan for your fitness, right? You need to look at what they're doing over a broader span of time.
Right. So I would love to hear about your medical practice. So you run a boutique sleep practice, and is this like concierge medicine for sleep? Tell us a little bit about your practice.
Yes. So in sleep medicine, I think we, in general, we do a pretty good job at screening and treating sleep apnea in our sleep clinics, but there are these pain points in every field, and one of them, I'd say the pain point is they're very time consuming. And with all the pressure we have as physicians to try to see like loads of patients during the day, chronic insomnia is one of those points. And so one of the reasons I started this practice was to be able to focus on that, because I couldn't really do that in like a system just because I needed to have longer visits. So I started my practice during the pandemic in order to really provide like a higher level of service to patients. And so I do have a physical office. I'm licensed in California and in Washington. Most of my patients are in Washington, but I'm also able to then get to people who are waiting like 6 months to get into the sleep center. And with this home testing, it's really easy to deploy, but then also providing cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or, you know, for the people who were like given their CPAP and it didn't work and that was the end of the medical care they received. I'm really working with them to try to, you know, help them with some of the things that obstacles they run into to address that and help them with like the next step. So just trying to provide a higher level of service that, you know, no offense to my colleagues because I've been in that type of practice, but you just can't provide that level of service given the pressures that are on you to see mm-hmm. that many patients a day.
Yeah. Yeah. I know being in the private practice world, it does give you that opportunity to kind of mold your practice how you want it. And I'm in private practice. I love it. I'm my own boss. There's a lot of advantages for sure. More risks, but definitely some advantages. It also gives you the opportunity to do other things. Like I get to podcast and, you know, work with other companies. I know you work with some other people. Can you tell us what's going on with Oslo Sleep?
Yes, I'm really excited about Oslo Sleep because we're talking about wearables. And, you know, I think that wearables are great in that they're providing a lot in terms of the perspective of a researcher. And they have a lot of advisors that are researchers. So I was really excited because one of the reasons that I decided to work with this company was they really value, like, we want to work with a sleep clinician that works with patients and really understands like what they're needing and how to help them. That's one of the big barriers, I think, as a physician. And I know you probably feel the same way because you're on social media and in doing a lot of outreach too. But you can have all this technology, but if it's not accessible and usable and isn't helpful to people, then it's only so great. And so what Oslo has done is they're kind of addressing a lot of things with sleep. So they are these earbuds that, unlike some of the other earbuds that are available, they're very comfortable for side sleeping. They can provide noise masking, which is really important for people who live in big cities, who have snoring spouses, who want to listen to like white noise or other types of noise masking, like brown noise. And then they're also going to have a sleep tracking capability. And if you think about having a tracker in the ear versus on the, like on the finger or on the wrist, for example, there's a lot of advantages to that. You know, instead of getting a peripheral temperature, you can get a core body temperature.
Interesting.
You can also provide a treatment to someone through an app, whether it's educational, whether it's a meditation, whether it's music therapy. You know, so there's a lot you can do with that ear-based therapy. So they're going to have like help for people who have tinnitus. That's a pretty common thing that comes up with older people too, is like you're alone with your thoughts trying to sleep and you have this
ringing in your ears. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm just really excited. And I think there's going to be a lot. I think there's going to be a lot that they can do. I don't know how you feel, but it's like, you know, I didn't think that I would ever be doing something like this, but I think having these tools and having both our medical training and perspective and our medical tools, along with things that are more accessible and reach a greater number of people, are important.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's always this bridge that sometimes difficult to form between, you know, what we call like bench science, somebody that's like literally in a lab working with, you know, whether it's petri dishes or chemicals, and then translating it into clinical practice. You know, that used to take, I think, on average, like 17 years before they could discover something that would actually translate into our clinic and our offices. I think now with social media and things like that, newer innovations are getting out faster and faster. But I think there's still times when people don't really understand what we do in medicine. you know, they can certainly do things direct to consumer, but I think that it's so good when you actually have a clinician that kind of understands, okay, this is what the patients are actually struggling with. And these are the obstacles that we have to overcome to get where we need to be. And so I think it's fantastic when, you know, companies use people like yourself to kind of bridge that gap in a sense to offer and provide something that's actually useful.
Yeah, so people can pre-order that on Indiegogo now, but it'll be launching to, I think, like a, you know, for anybody, and available in April, hopefully. And
yeah. I'm really excited. So this is something that like is like the size of an earbud that goes in the ear?
It is. And basically Bose, if you know that company, they used to have a product called Sleep Buds. And what happened was three executives from Bose decided that they wanted to pursue this as a sleep wearable. And so they acquired the intellectual property and they left and formed their own company. And so it'll be both the earbud and then actually an app where the app will contain a lot of content and, you know, hopefully education and information and therapy for people for different medical reasons. Or health and wellness reasons, I should say.
Is there any concern with EMF? Like I've heard people talk about like, don't sleep with your cell phone close to you, figure out where the Wi-Fi routers are in your house. What is the data on EMF and sleep?
We don't really have any data to show. Like I know one thing that has come up, and this has been going on like since I was a resident in like 2007 or is this going to cause a brain tumor? And there's no evidence of that. It really has not been shown, I think, to increase the incidence of things like brain tumors. I think the one thing with the earbuds is you do have to make sure they're not too loud and you do have to make sure you're not damaging your ears. So that's the one thing I would just tell people with listening to sounds is you just have to make sure it's safe levels.
Yeah.
And you will be able, like with these, I think there's regulations that they have to pass for it to be like safe levels. And then also like with these, like you should be able to hear a crying baby. You should be able to hear your smoke.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Like safety concerns.
Yeah.
That's how I felt after this crazy sleep. It was like a hot chocolate. I'm going to have to figure out what the heck I actually took, you guys. But
that wasn't scary. I mean, yeah. In a way you'd be like, oh my gosh.
No, it was. I mean, I've ever since my girls were born, I feel like I'm easily arousable in my sleep. And I'm sure some of it too is just being on call and just like, I actually don't even have to have the ringer on my phone. I can wake up to it buzzing, which is helpful because then my husband isn't hearing the phone ring all night when I'm on call. But yeah, that was like a level I've never achieved on Super Mario Brothers, I feel like, when it came to sleep. But well, this has been so wonderful, Dr. Broderick. Thank you for your expertise and your tips and tricks and for doing what you do, you know, and helping so many patients sleep better, which ultimately leads to longer, healthy, happier lives.
Thank you for having me.
Did you guys love that last episode of the Fit and Fabulous podcast? Well, of course you did. And I want to keep bringing you the most amazing content from the most incredible people. And you can help me by subscribing to the Dr. Fit and Fabulous channel. You guys know where the button is. Just click it. It's the doctor's orders.